It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after cyber attacks and terror threats against theaters scheduled to screen the movie The Interview, Sony Pictures says it's not going to release the film. We look at what's behind that decision.
But first, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee has a new head honcho. Interim Chancellor Mark Mone assumed the permanent role this week.
Although it's the second largest UW campus in the state, it's sometimes overshadowed by UW-Madison, and with Marquette University right next door, more or less, UW-Milwaukee has to work to stand out among other higher education institutions.
Chancellor Mone joins us now to talk about where he hopes to take the UW-Milwaukee during his tenure. Chancellor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, before your official appointment to the role of chancellor, you've been serving as interim chancellor since May. What initiatives have you started that you want to carry forward and develop?
Well, one of the central ones that we've started during my tenure is to have a real intense focus on some of the student centricity and some of the things that we're working on around our enrollments. We look at those as vital to provide a great quality experience for our students while they're on campus, as well as preparing them for their life beyond when they're on campus. So that might be in the employment sector, it might be in additional grad school, or other things that they want to do, such as circle back and pursue additional education or other development opportunities. So over the last 3 or 4 years, we've followed the trends with a lot of other institutions of higher ed in the state and have faced some challenges regarding enrollment. So that's been a real critical initiative for us to pursue.
Well, now that you're in the role of chancellor, what is at the top of your wish list for UW-Milwaukee?
Well, you know, we have had tremendous impact on the region in a couple of different key ways. One is for our students to serve as an important part of the workforce. So we've got about 158,000 alumni with almost 80% that stay in the state. So it was, we look at the work that's done in all sorts of different organizations from manufacturing to healthcare, financial services, and so forth. We really see that as important. But I think what will be just vital going forward in the future is to not only continue that, addressing the needs of what will make a huge difference for the impact of this state in terms of economic development, but to really look at the other things that a research university such as UWM does. So my wish list would be for us to really strengthen and deepen the types of partnerships in which we engage the business community, the education sector, the areas around research and scientific applications that advance work in water technologies, in a variety of different settings that truly make a difference. We're well aligned with the work that happens in the state around some of the major sectors and clusters, but to continue to strengthen and help move Wisconsin forward from where we have been in the last several years and really move us ahead in a more prominent way to really bolster the state and really work in collaboration with our state government, our Board of Regents, and other partners that we have.
UW-Milwaukee and other campuses around the state sometimes seem to live a little bit in the shadow of UW-Madison. What do you think it would take to get UW-Milwaukee more into the spotlight?
Probably two things would help us in terms of coming out of the shadow, as I think you've described it. One is to have even greater collaboration in the region, and we're well on our way toward that. So we have 21 institutions of higher ed at the 2- and 4-year level, and we're seeing a lot of collaboration, and I'd like to continue to deepen that type of relationship in ways that we haven't seen before. But I also think that people don't always know the type of collaboration that we actually have with Madison around a number of research fronts. The most recent that I could tell you about would be our Johnson Controls Professorship, where we are really on the leading edge globally for some lithium-ion energy storage research. We hired a professor who is joint with Madison and UW-Milwaukee, sponsored by Johnson Control in part, and we are developing in conjunction in that three-way collaboration some of the most important work that is recognized in industry by by a number of folks in government in terms of the federal dollars that have come in to support that kind of research. So that's just one example, but we do all sorts of things in collaboration with Madison, and Chancellor Blank and I have a deep commitment to strengthen and do even more things in that way.
Well, now that you've got the podium as chancellor, what contributions do you think UW-Milwaukee does bring at a statewide level that you think more people should be aware of? You mentioned the collaboration with UW-Madison. Are there other things?
Well, another example would be one of the clusters, one of the areas of development in the future is around biomedical research. And some of the commitments that we've made out at our innovation campus to be close to the Medical College of Wisconsin, but also to align with other universities in the area. So we're having a lot of discussions right now, and there's verbal commitments for a number of universities, and we're not at the MOU being signed stage, but we see in 2015 even more a strengthening of the work in that area. And I think why that's important to the state of Wisconsin is that we have different parts of universities and industry and parts of the community that are involved in different ways that have strengths. But if we can work together in a collaborative way, trying to address some of the important questions in that area, try to resolve some of the unknown issues, we'll be so much more strong. We'll be so much stronger that it can help put us on a national and international profile for some of the key findings and some of the key developments that can spawn new companies, that can solve health issues, that can really strengthen the funding resources that flow into the state for that type of work.
Republican Robin Voss recently said that in the next session, coming up in about 2 weeks, he wants the legislature to look more closely at how much time UW professors are spending in the classroom and some other time allocation issues. What is your response to those concerns?
I think that we all should have accountability in any type of organization. And given my background, I know quite a bit about the quest for accountability, and higher ed is not exempt from that. So I think that it gives us an opportunity to demonstrate the important work that happens both in the classroom and out of the classroom. And that's true at the comprehensive universities as well as the research universities. We have between Madison and Milwaukee a tremendous amount of effort that is underway. And I think if you look at the work that happens with our students outside of the classroom in terms of the supervision of the quality of work that's done, and the other things that faculty members do, I think we can demonstrate significant accountability.
The Wisconsin Policy Research Institute has called Milwaukee a city in crisis and is suggesting that part of that issue stems from a low number of people who have four-year degrees in the city. Do you think that UWM could be doing more to attract and retain and graduate more people with four-year degrees?
You know, that's a really important issue, and if I can broaden it just a little bit first, and then I'll come back and answer the question directly. I would argue and agree, certainly, that Milwaukee is on the map, oftentimes for many of the wrong reasons. There's just statistic after statistic. We see it certainly weekly, if not daily, in terms of a number of social issues that Milwaukee and, frankly, Madison have in terms of graduation rates, poverty, incarceration, and a number of other important issues. UW-Milwaukee can play an even bigger part in partnership with other institutions of higher ed, as well as the K-12 system, with elected officials. And I think we have not just an opportunity, but as the largest public research university serving southeastern Wisconsin and one that really serves the largest number of Wisconsin residents, I think we have an obligation to engage. And part of it is what you're talking about in terms of the number of degrees. So our graduation rate, our retention rate, we will be working on those. That's part of the initiatives that I've been working on and will continue. I also think that developing a strong resource base and working in collaboration with both Milwaukee Public Schools, MATC, and then broadening that to work with the Choice, Charter, and other two-year school systems in the region is a really important part of helping to address that. So I feel very committed and look forward to taking on some of those issues in collaboration with others in the region.
Leadership turnover has been pretty frequent relative to other campuses. I wonder if you think that has affected progress at UW-Milwaukee.
Well, I think some have suggested that, and certainly many people have said that's one of the things that they look at when you talk about turnover at any academic institution, why there's some comfort with the fact that I've been at UW-Milwaukee for 25-plus years and plan on staying here, maybe not for 25 more, but certainly some lengthy period. I think that if you look at the national average, probably for public institutions, I think 4 years is about the average. So it's not too surprising. And if you look at the progress that's been made for UW-Milwaukee with our last three chancellors, I think it's just been nothing short of remarkable. While each of them have been different, they have continued to move this campus forward in important ways. So I look forward to building on their progress and their greatness, and would hope to be here a long time. And yet, to your point, I do hear that a lot in the community. I, having been here for a long time, have felt that myself, that the stability and leadership allows us to really move things more in a more committed way and have a bigger impact. So those are my thoughts on that.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Mark Mone, the new chancellor of UW-Milwaukee. Sony Pictures Entertainment announced yesterday that it's going to cancel its Christmas Day release of the film The Interview, a comedy which shows a fictionalized assassination attempt on Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
Let's listen to a clip from the movie's trailer starring James Franco and Seth Rogen as journalists who are asked to assassinate the North Korean leader. This clip features CIA agent Lacey as portrayed by Lizzie Kaplan.
Mr. Rappaport, I'm Agent Lacey with Central Intelligence. You two are going to be in a room alone with Kim.
We got the interview!
The CIA would love it if you could take him out.
Hmm?
Take him out.
Like for drinks?
Like to dinner?
Take him out of the town?
No, take him out.
You want us to kill the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What?
You won't be seeing the rest of that movie anytime soon. The media giant's decision to pull it comes after terror threats, a big cyber attack. The threats against movie theaters prompted the four largest theater chains to cancel screenings of the film.
This was just the latest threat leveled at Sony over the movie. Last month, hackers believed to be linked to the North Korean regime launched a punishing attack on Sony's computers, making off with private emails, details of executive salaries, and digital copies of several unreleased Sony films.
With us now is Fred Kate. He's Distinguished Professor of Law at Indiana University and Senior Fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. Fred, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, with this news that Sony's effectively burying the movie, is this an incentive for future similar attacks, maybe from the same group, maybe for others?
Yeah, I think it easily could be. I mean, cyber attacks have been used for years in an effort to extort money. So, for example, the state of Virginia was attacked maybe 5 years ago. Attackers got in to their public health database about claims that the state had paid and said, look, we're going to release this publicly if you don't give us money. Typically, people who have been approached for money don't provide the money. And in fact, it's consistent with the U.S. policy on terrorism generally. You know, we don't pay money for hostages. We don't negotiate with terrorists. This case is a pretty prominent example of a major U.S. corporation giving in to terrorists.
So what should we read into Sony's decision? What were the incentives for them to cave and not release this movie?
Well, I mean, Sony really was dealt a double blow here. The first was the major attack on its computers, and as you mentioned, you know, the information about prior films, about film stars, about salaries, executives, embarrassing emails, and lots of employee data being stolen and leaked onto the internet. The other was, of course, over the past few days, they've learned that the major film movie chains in the United States weren't going to screen the film. So they could say they were releasing it, but it was going to suddenly become an art house film if the major commercial chains weren't going to carry it. And so what appears to have happened is that Sony sort of bowed to this pressure, of this combined 1-2 punch, and said they have no plans to release it at all now.
Now, the group behind both that initial cyber attack and the threats apparently against the movie theater chains calls itself the Guardians of Peace. What, if anything, do we know about them?
Well, we don't know a lot about them. If you think about the way that cyber attacks really work, the only clue we generally get in a cyber attack is by looking at the actual code used in the attack, the actual computer instructions that were used to steal the data. And in this case, we have a lot of leaked information from the federal government. We thought law enforcement would be making a public statement today. They have not done so, so maybe they're delaying till tomorrow, maybe they're delaying longer than that. But what we know is that the code used here appears to have been created in Korean, and it follows a very similar pattern to an attack on South Korean banks that has been, I think, pretty authoritatively traced to North Korea that took place earlier this year. And so those two together really suggest that the attacks did originate in Korea. And, of course, the assumption is nothing major originates in Korea without the authority of the Korean government.
Now, if we were in a movie here, and this almost feels like a movie plot, there would be some good guy hackers tracking step by step the attack to its origin. Is that actually possible in the real world?
It is possible. It's actually illegal in the United States. So, for example, if Sony wanted to hire somebody to do that, they would be breaking federal law. And Congress and the administration recently issued warnings to U.S. companies who are wanting to what we call hack back that they better be careful because they would almost certainly violate federal law if they did so. In this case, because of the size of the attack, because of the source of it, and because of the nature of the threat, the administration has been holding high-level meetings internally, and we might expect some sort of federal government response. And, you know, that can include anything from, you know, intensified sanctions. We already have a lot of sanctions against North Korea, but there's certainly more that could be done. Or we could see some sort of attack back, as in fact, you know, it's now, I think, pretty clear the United States attacked Iran in order to limit its uranium centrifuge capacity. We could see a similar attack against North Korea in order to limit some essential or military activity there.
Now, if I'm a company, why is it illegal for me to try to hack back, to try to trace the origin of an attack against my stuff?
Well, it's illegal because Congress says it is illegal. In other words, hacking's a really tricky business. It's not all that difficult to do, but it's very hard to firmly identify the source of something. So I think Congress's fear here is that if companies could sort of act as vigilantes and get rough justice, they might very well get it against the wrong party. So, you know, imagine that a hacker takes over Wisconsin Public Radio's servers and then uses it to launch an attack on me. If I attack back, I'm going to end up attacking the wrong people. I'm going to go after Wisconsin Public Radio when it really should have been somebody else. And so the fear of that kind of retribution against the wrong party has really caused a really bright line here. It's okay to do some forensics to try to discover what happened, to try to discover the source, but you can't try to execute justice on your own.
Now, was there something wrong with the company here, Sony, being underprepared when it comes to security, or are they the norm in the corporate world?
Well, you know, we don't know is the honest answer, and I think we will certainly learn more over time. You know, Sony suffered a very famous attack on its PlayStation site. It led to the PlayStation being down for some time, and I think that was 4 years ago, 3 years ago. The sort of view after that attack is that they were pretty unprepared at the time. Now, you know, 3 years later, and after suffering something like that, you would expect they would be much better prepared. And in all honesty, being well prepared is not always a guaranteed way to avoid trouble. I mean, we saw, you know, major successful attack, for example, against the Chase Manhattan Bank this year, and Chase is widely regarded in the industry as, you know, one of the absolute leaders in cybersecurity and spends millions and millions of dollars on it. So it may turn out Sony was unprepared. It may turn out they were prepared and just had bad luck or faced a particularly determined adversary.
Now, Sony didn't just lose a lot of information that's now being published all over the place. I saw one employee quoted saying, yeah, we're right now state of the art if this was 2002. How much did this attack wreck Sony's internal computer systems?
Well, I mean, we are told some of the computers aren't back up. They're not sure if they can use them. And this attack, in the cyber sort of forensics world, we're always saying, what is it most like? You know, what does this remind us of? And there was a very successful attack by Iran against Aramco, the Saudi Arabian oil company, that actually made more than 1,000 computers unusable forever. They were never able to get them back online. We may be looking at something like that here, although, to be honest, the evidence we have right now suggests that the really big hit on this attack was the data taken out from Sony. It's not going to be the lasting effect on the systems that Sony actually owns.
We'll get into that a little bit more in a few. We're talking about Sony Pictures' decision to cancel the release of the new movie, The Interview, after a cyber attack, after threats of terrorism, and what this means for entertainment companies, for the business world, and consumers going forward.
And we'd like to hear from you. Did Sony make the right call in scrapping the movie just before opening day? What else could they have done? And what does this say about the power of cyber attacks? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about Sony's decision to cancel its film, The Interview, after a cyber attack and then some terror threats against theaters scheduled to screen that movie. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about Sony's decision? Would you go to a movie if the venue had received terror threats? What should the U.S. government's response be, if anything? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us a tweet to @CentralTimeWPR.
Fred Kate stays with us. He's a distinguished professor of law at Indiana University and a senior fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. Fred, before the break, we were talking about the impact of this attack on Sony's computer systems, the information that got released. How about the employees, the people who work for Sony? Should they be worried about their information that might be out there? Is this something scary for anybody who works at a place?
Yeah, I'm so glad you raised that, because to my mind, that's almost been the underreported part of this story. I mean, you know, we've learned a lot of things from this breach, and I suspect those things are true not just of Sony, but of many other companies and government agencies and not-for-profit organizations. So one is saving way too much information. Those embarrassing emails wouldn't be there to be released if they weren't being stored, but we tend to store everything. Another is that cybersecurity breaches, you know, these hacking attacks, they don't just threaten customers, they also threaten the employees. And in this breach, we've had health data release, we've had social security numbers, we've had passport numbers, really sensitive information, important information. And again, information is not clear why it was being stored on the web or being sent by email to start with. So I think that's a really critical lesson here that we could all take away, is to think, what do you have on your computer right now that would be harmful or embarrassing to you if it was made public that you don't need to be on the Internet?
Now, Kenneth from Janesville called in at 800-642-1234 in answer to our question, should Sony have caved in to these hackers and canceled the movie? He said, Sony lost a lot of money on this. True. They should have continued with the screenings, maybe even up to the price of admission. So one thought there that Sony should have stuck with it. I mean, and one point that's been raised is, Fred, that just because they have the ability to do this cyber attack, that doesn't necessarily translate into the ability to carry through with the physical terror attacks that these hackers had threatened.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I have to say here, on the one hand, I'm really cautious. I mean, we're all Monday morning quarterbacking here, and Sony certainly found itself in a hard position. And especially the criticism it's been getting today from members of Congress seems a little rich, given that Congress has done almost nothing to address cybersecurity challenges in the past few years. But on the other hand, I think there's been a lot of surprise that Sony didn't at least say, we can release the movie online, or we can release it in DVDs, or we can release it in pay-per-view. All ways that kind of reduce the threat of a large physical congregation of people, but still make it possible to get it out there. I actually suspect, this wasn't going to be a blockbuster film in any event, and after all of this attention, Sony very well might have made more money on it than it would have without all of the attacks. So I'm a little surprised. I mean, I think it really suggests how cornered they have felt by this threat.
Still time for you to weigh in on the question at 800-642-1234. Should Sony have canceled the release of this movie, The Interview, after attacks, cyber attacks, and threats from a group apparently linked to North Korea? 800-642-1234. Now, Fred, we've seen over the years non-governmental things, hacktivism, groups like Anonymous using the power of the internet to tackle people over various political issues. Are there lessons that we can learn in common, or are these very different stories?
Well, I mean, in some ways they're very different, but you know, almost everyone who launches attack has a motivation, and that motivation may be steal money, it may be embarrass you, it may be demonstrate that they can do it, it may be protest that they don't like the fact you're making a movie. But understanding the motivation is a pretty key place to start. But I suspect the real takeaway here is the sense of, if someone's really determined to get in, I doubt if any of us are really that secure. That certainly appears to be the evidence. You know, we've lived through a year of unbelievable attacks. We started the year with Target. We had Home Depot. We had major attacks at Amazon. We've just seen, you know, the iPhone, iCloud photographs being released. There's a certain sense at which our technology has gotten way ahead of our ability to protect it, and this may be a real wake-up call to say, you know, even a major multinational company can face really devastating attacks and not be prepared for them.
Well, let's go to our callers now. We've got Steve on the line in Madison. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon. Every third caller is wondering the same question. I'm surprised that you two haven't already brought it to mind. When the movie comes up, a wonderful comedy comes up about the assassination of the President of the United States, how will that be received?
Gotcha, Steve. Thanks. And that's something that a lot of people, and I've seen entertainment analysts say, this movie did cross a line that you don't usually cross, portraying the death of a world leader, cuddly or not. Do you think that maybe Sony, the movie makers, were inviting trouble by portraying this, Fred?
Well, I mean, I think that's an issue on which probably everyone has their own opinion, and none of us are more qualified. You know, nobody's an expert on this subject. Sony knew it was biting off a pretty controversial topic just by taking on North Korea. I'm fairly confident that if Sony had made a picture about the President of the United States being assassinated, that the U.S. government would not have attacked Sony in this way. And I think it's a daunting prospect to think that even someone who causes offense, maybe completely inappropriately, I mean, that's just a judgment issue, but would instead of facing public outrage, would instead face devastating cyber attacks that would harm really hundreds, maybe thousands of people, you know, not just the company that was involved in making the decision.
Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Saeed in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Yes, I am flabbergasted by the ease with which the perpetrators here have intimidated us. If this was our approach and we were citizens of Israel, we would basically be staying home, not participating in any commerce or social engagement with one another from fear of terrorism. This is the objective of terrorism, is to instill fear in us. We have 19, 20, 21-year-old kids overseas dying to defend our freedoms, yet we voluntarily give up our freedom of speech here.
Saeed, thanks for the call. So that's similar to the question we started off with, Fred, that maybe folding quickly makes the case for more of this kind of behavior from this group of hackers or others.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Saeed said, and he said it more eloquently than I could, so I think I'll just stop there.
Okay. Thanks, Saeed. We'll go back to the calls now with Jesse with us in Madison. Jesse, hi.
Hi there. I guess my question is what the government's doing to respond to this, basically a terrorist threat. I know at where I work, if somebody threatened to hurt me based on something the company was doing, I would be more than grateful if the company decided not to do it anymore. But how is the government responding to this threat from basically hackers or terrorists from North Korea. Thanks.
Jesse, thanks. Fred, you mentioned earlier, you know, there's a lot that we don't know what we're talking about behind closed doors, possibly more sanctions. Are there things at the federal level that could be done to encourage better cybersecurity at corporations or to help protect those corporations?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that can be done, and some of which are starting to be done, some of which we haven't even begun on. I mean, one thing is, of course, we have this enormous cyber capacity base, both in the National Security Agency and in the Pentagon more generally, and making that more available for the use of industry to help protect industry or to help respond if industry attacked is certainly one thing that I'm sure has been much talked about in the corridors of power tonight. Another is we have currently very little law that creates any obligation to provide good security. So if you are a customer, if you're an employee of mine, you really have no guarantee whether I provide good security or not. And, you know, we might want to see some basic standards set by law, just like we have for highway safety or food safety. We might want some cyber safety standards that we could all rely on, given that most of us don't have the technological ability or the time to measure the security of the systems we're interacting with.
Jesse, thanks. Now Tim is with us in Kenosha. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I think it's ridiculous that they pulled the movie, the hack aside, out of a sense of safety for moviegoers, because as far as I've read, the threat that there would be some kind of physical attack was completely incredible. And North Korea is known for making these, you know, ridiculous, bellicose statements. And I just don't understand why anybody would think that anything was really going to happen when terror analysts and people who know their stuff said that there was absolutely no physical threat whatsoever to anyone.
Tim, thanks for that call and that perspective. And Fred, one thing I've seen talking about movie theaters and about Sony is the issue of fear of liability. And I wonder if fear of liability and maybe insurance companies are going to be promoting a lot of behavioral changes in the world of cybersecurity down the road.
Well, I think that's right, and I also think we might think about liability in another sense, not just economic or legal liability, but, you know, every time something bad happens, we all tend to kind of rush to judgment. There's a shooting in a theater, and we say, why didn't the theater have guards, or why didn't the theater have metal detectors, or, you know, we the public, and certainly members of Congress, often make kind of outrageous claims after the fact about what should have been done. So here's a case in which, again, I'm not defending the theaters. I would have made a different decision. But, you know, they know if they had made the decision to go ahead and there were something that happened, whether or not done by North Korea, even just done by somebody in the U.S. Who took action, they would then all be judged not just by the courts and by their insurance companies, but also by the public and by our political leaders. And we'd be for not taking this more seriously.
Well, Fred, thanks as always for joining us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
That's Fred Cade. He's Distinguished Professor of Law at Indiana University, and he's a senior fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. First, we take a look at the continued rise of craft beer in America. The last decade has seen a big shift in the way Americans consume beer. It's even more profound when you take a look at some recently released sales numbers.
In 2013, more barrels of craft beer were shipped than those of the Budweiser brand. Make that about 16.1 million for craft beers and 16 million for Budweiser. It's the first time craft beer has outsold the Budweiser brand, and a gigantic leap from 10 years ago when Budweiser shipped about 10 times as much beer as all the craft breweries combined.
Here to talk about the significance of that milestone and the economic boon the craft beer boom is creating in the state is Robin Shepherd. He's a regional beer writer and beer correspondent for ISPIS in Madison. He's also the author of Wisconsin's Best Breweries and Brew Pubs, Searching for the Perfect Pint. Robin, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be here.
So we mentioned those sales numbers. Stack up all those little craft breweries and medium-sized craft breweries. They've actually outsold the Budweiser, not Bud Light, but the Budweiser brand itself. Does this mean something?
Well, it's an interesting time to be a beer enthusiast. When you think about it, the numbers that you're quoting about Budweiser are really, there's a broader set of numbers that is a slice of. When you think about what's happening overall in beer consumption in the country, in the U.S., it declined about 2% last year. But this segment that we see that we called craft beer, that grew by 17% to a point now where craft beer overall sales are about 7.8% of all the beer that's sold in the country.
So why did this happen? What led to this growth in craft beers?
Well, there's a lot of things. You know, success sort of breeds success in many ways, and it's hard to sort of say this is the one particular thing that has created almost like a tipping point, at least in our interest of craft beer at the present time. But you think about the push in the last 15 to 20 years over locally made products, locally produced items. That local intensity or identity that comes with the pride of a brewery in your backyard, in your community. You know, there's a sort of a demand for flavorful foods overall, and the craft beer movement clearly fits into that. There's an extreme beer interest now that there's sort of, you take that flavorful interest, that extreme flavor desire, and take that to the next level of what can we, you know, what intensity is there. There are all other things that are sort of happening. The push for experimental beers have followed or mimicked a lot of what we see in leading-edge cuisine and interesting food dishes. You know, it's not so coincidental that we have the rise of the Food Network. Mm-hmm. You know, the beer movement sort of echoes all of that at the same time. Then there's a culture also that I think I'm part of, and it's almost as if it's a scavenger hunt of, can I find the communities that these small breweries are in? Can I find the beer? Not out of, you know, the quantity of the beer, but rather the quality of the beer and the story, the journey of finding them, that scavenger hunt of, can I find them? That has spawned a whole interest in beer tourism, believe it or not, and we're seeing destination breweries crop up where people want to go on vacation just to see, take a tour of this particular brewery or to this particular region. Wisconsin has always had a wonderful history of brewing that we have attracted a lot of people into our old breweries of Milwaukee. But now we're really beginning to see places like Madison, Door County, Green Bay, parts, neighborhoods of Milwaukee that have become beer destinations.
Well, you mentioned, you know, a big, long brewing tradition in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin, on those large-scale breweries. How do we stack up compared to the rest of the nation when it comes to craft beer?
Well, historically, our historical roots in the large, bigger breweries have kind of, in some ways, I think, slowed us down to embracing some of the modern craft beer movement.
That didn't. The big beers were local beers.
Right. Those big beers were local beers. There was a lot of pride in Milwaukee and those large breweries that went with them. And so we were a little slower to embrace the micro craft beer movement. And when I quote you the numbers of 7.8%, those are numbers from the Brewers Association. There are folks in Wisconsin that kind of watch those numbers and would say that overall our craft beer consumption in the state is probably closer to 5%, because we were kind of slow to kind of come to the dance in terms of our craft beer movement. In terms of our numbers, though, we're still about, I think, number 10. If you put all the states and just look at the numbers, not per capita breweries, but we have somewhere around 90 to 100 brewing properties that are active. There are more brewing permits in the works right now, but active brewers probably a little over 90, and that puts us at number 10. But it also comes with it, the realization that Wisconsin still has that long historical image of being the beer state. I mean, from 1962 to 1982, given those big breweries in Milwaukee, we were the number one producing state in the entire country for that 20-year period.
Does craft beer have that kind of economic potential for Wisconsin?
Oh, absolutely. If you think about what this craft beer movement is about, beer movement overall, it kind of depends upon whether you look at industry numbers or other people who track the industry, but generally the beer in the U.S., all beer, is around a $220 billion enterprise. Craft beer, if you think about that slice of it, its economic impact is closer to $35 to $40 billion. If you break that down into the states, Wisconsin, for example, with its 90 breweries, it has an impact of about $855 million, direct impact. That's not the secondary impact, mind you, of all the trickle-out industries. That's the direct impact from industry numbers. We employ about 9,800 workers. The average worker in brewing makes about $30,000 a year. If you look around the states, we're probably pretty equitable with Minnesota, with about 50 breweries and a $750 million economic kind of contribution to that state.
Now, Budweiser, seeing itself outsold by all those other craft beers, or all the craft beers combined, says they're going to change their marketing and try to target a younger generation. Is this partly a generational shift we're seeing toward craft beers?
Well, I think everybody, whether it's the craft industry and the big guys, they're all watching what 80 million millennials are going to mean to the food, the beverage industry purchasing period. And where does that group of audience take us? When you're really big, like Budweiser or InBev, Anheuser-Busch, Miller Coors, you think about what they can do in marketing to pick up a 2% drop in their own product. I mean, they have some resources that the small guys don't have. So I don't think that we're going to see Budweiser go away anytime soon. Will they rally? They have already been rallying. You see groups like InBev have developed sort of niche aspects of what they do with specialized products like Shop Top, or they have embraced a group of breweries to help distribute and get those beers out, like Red Hook, which is a very popular West Coast micro craft beer. Miller, for example, has its 10th and Blake Brewery, which is a special arm, a special brewery that it handles things like Leinenkugels and their Big Eddie lineup. So they have rallied around this interest in craft beer.
I think of the alcohol industry in general as a really complicated one in some ways to break into for a small business. Each state has its laws on how you can sell, how you can distribute, whether you can distribute across state lines, a lot of things. Is that loosening up? Is it easier for a little guy to, you know, break out into new markets?
Well, every state has a different set of laws, and I think, in Wisconsin, there's a lot of talk about when a brewery or a brew pub comes in, they need to pre-identify itself as a brewery or a brew pub, and then that kind of locks them into a certain type of evolution as a business. And I think there'll be continued interest over changing some of those laws. Many of the laws that are still on the books that govern this industry, you know, date back to the end of Prohibition. And so each state has that ability to tweak those depending upon what they would like to see that industry, how they'd like to see that industry grow.
You mentioned beer tourism. Are we seeing much of that in Wisconsin yet?
Oh, very much so. Earlier in the summer, I did a little work looking at Door County in terms of, you know, we all think of Door County, how beautiful it is with the cherries and the wineries. It's been fascinating over the last couple of years to watch the number of special beer bars that are now, you know, catering to the tourism in Door County. They now have two brew pubs in Door County, a third, if you count Annapi, in Algoma, that's sort of at the doorway to Door County. Festivals are a big thing. Door County alone now has two annual festivals, but festivals bring in a lot of people. If you think about Madison and its Great Taste of the Midwest, one of the best outdoor festivals, 6,000 tickets. It's got to rock concert status where people camp out waiting for tickets the day or two before so that they can get in line to get those tickets.
Well, before we let you go, Robin, any microbrews that you're excited about these days?
Well, it's winter is a fun time. I'm very much a seasonal scavenger. And I love the darker, heavier, more malty, more sweeter brews of the season. And things like some rich Belgians, some very bold stouts are always wonderful on my mind, or always on my mind right now. I just had a beer earlier in the week that was unveiled for the first time at the Great Dane Brew Pubs that was made in partnership with Wollersheim Winery. About 80% of its beer, 20% of it is their Prairie Fumée wine, and it was quite exquisite. It was a Belgian triple that had its own fruitiness that was really accentuated by that wonderful white grape.
Sounds great. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was beer writer Robin Shepherd. Joins us to talk about the continued rise of craft beer and the economic opportunities it has for Wisconsin.